How the hell did it come this far when we send our children to die in war?
The striking things about being in Baghdad now, social workers and doctors and so forth have reported there's a great upsurge of the taking of tranquilizers, particularly among children.
I challenge the American intelligence, the Israeli intelligence, and the British intelligence to bring one shred of valid evidence that such nuclear weapon program has been in Iraq for the past 11 years.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, February 12, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Bush administration is turning up the heat on United Nations head weapons inspector Hans Blix to word his statement to the Security Council Committee Friday in strong enough language to persuade wavering council members to support an immediate move towards war. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice flew to New York this morning for an unannounced meeting with Blix. The U.S. and Britain are considering introducing a resolution as early as next week that could pave the way for war. CIA Director George Tenet warned the Senate yesterday that the desire for nuclear weapons among smaller nations of the world is on an upsurge. According to Tenet, Iran, North Korea, Libya, and Iraq are all making moves to obtain equipment to produce weapons-grade nuclear materials over the past 12 years. Secretary of State Colin Powell, in a partly plagiarized speech last week before the UN Security Council Committee, presented satellite images, audio recordings, and Iraqi defectors to portray Iraq as a nation harboring weapons of mass destruction. And while many embrace Powell's multimedia presentation as convincing and damning for Saddam Hussein, a growing number of critics have dismissed the report as less than credible. Imad Kaduri is a former Iraqi nuclear scientist. He worked for the Iraqi Atomic Energy Commission for 30 years, from 1968 to 1998. During an interview with him earlier this week, we asked Kaduri to describe Iraq's nuclear capability at the time he left his position.
When I left my position in 1998, the nuclear weapon capability was zero, nothing. But there was still a nuclear research center. There was still some ordinary peaceful use of research being done in physics department, chemistry department, biology department. But the nuclear weapon program itself completely ceased to exist immediately after the end of the 1990 war. By then, all the scientists and engineers were redirected from their nuclear weapon program. The management of the nuclear weapon program slowly disintegrated.
So that was in 1998. This is 2003. Do you think it's conceivable that Iraq has nuclear capabilities today?
It would be laughable to consider such a thing, because such a nuclear weapon program is not a thing that can be done in a mobile laboratory. This requires a huge amount of infrastructure. All our infrastructure, well, half of it, was bombed by American bombs, and some of them unknowingly by the United States during the war. And the rest of the structures were demolished by the IAEA inspectors in the years following the 1990 war.
Mr. Kaduri, in his speech before the UN Security Council, Secretary Powell said that an Iraqi defector has provided information that Iraq initiated a crash program in order to build a crude nuclear weapon after its invasion of Kuwait in 1995, and that the U.S. has more than a decade of proof that Saddam Hussein remains determined to acquire nuclear weapons. What's your response to that?
The first part is false, partly false, and the second part is completely false. Yes. When Iraq did go to Kuwait, invade Kuwait, the program that was already existing, nuclear weapon program, for about 10 years in Iraq, apparently not to the knowledge of the great CIA and all their human resources and financial resources, they didn't know about the extent of the program. But when Iraq went to Kuwait, yes, there was a crash program to, in a sense, accelerate the pace already highly accelerated for the past 10 years before the invasion of Kuwait. So partly, yes, that was true. But the next part of the statement is completely false.
Which part now?
The part that says that Iraq continued on its nuclear weapon programs. I challenge the American intelligence, the Israeli intelligence, and the British intelligence to bring one shred of evidence, valid evidence, that such nuclear weapon program has been in Iraq for the past 11 years. It's totally false. It's totally irrefutable. And the IAEA inspectors can very well verify that, and they have done that.
Much
yet Bush and Colin Powell keep waving this stolen red flag in front of the American people's eyes to incite them to war.
Well, Powell's info, much of it comes from the Iraqi defectors. Can you speak about some of the scientists you worked with who have since provided information to the U.S. government? And I'm thinking specifically of the case of Kadhir Hamza, who wrote the book Saddam's Bomb Maker.
Well, somebody asked me if I'd like to have a debate with this gentleman, and my response was the following. I'd rather have a debate with a spy, with a CIA agent for two reasons. The first, Kadhir Hamza has become simply a mouthpiece for the CIA, so it's better to talk with the source of the information than with him, because he has nothing to say. Second, at least the CIA agent would have at least some remnants of his self-dignity and his self-respect. His claims in his book are many of them are exaggerated, false. The title of the book is Saddam's Bomb Maker, and he says that he was in charge of the bomb making. Some parts are true. In 1997, he did submit a report to the government saying that the progress of work already 6 years or 7 years was faltering. Investigation was carried on that. And Hussein Kamel, the trusted right-hand man of the government, put Hussein Kamel in charge of the whole program. And Hussein Kamel appointed Kadhir Hamza to head a group to design the nuclear bomb. Well, he only lasted a few months. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because he stole air conditioning units from the building he was assigned to. And he became a non-entity after that. He remained marginal until he retired in 1989 before the crash program and he claimed things that never were true, that he was in charge of the building which housed the nuclear weapon design team. He never even had an office in that building. And on, I have written an article on this regarding Kadhir Hamza's false claims throughout the 25 years that I've known him.
Okay, would you consider it naive or unreasonable to expect that Iraqi scientists living in Iraq now will feel free enough to speak openly and honestly with the UN inspectors, given the threat that Saddam Hussein poses to them and their families?
No, this is not a naive question. What I think is naive and belligerent is the manner with which the UN MIVOC, and there are some of them are still part of the UNSCOM, the CIA agents in that team, in the prison team. The way they invaded the privacy of the home of Faleh Hamza, the scientist who was working on laser enrichment, that line of work, that line of enrichment, which was mentioned by Powell as another so-called evidence, that line of work was not part of the nuclear weapon program. It was part of the Nuclear Research Center and the Physics Department, and it was a cul-de-sac. It was dropped in 1987 or 88. It didn't lead anywhere. And this we even mentioned in our report in 1997, which we submitted, the final report we submitted to the IAEA. And when they submitted their report on Iraq, the nuclear non-capability in 1997, they referred that this work on laser enrichment was a dead end, was a cul-de-sac, and had nothing to do with the nuclear weapon program.
But Professor Haddouri,
these people, inspectors, barged in this guy's home with cameras in his private bedroom, photographing the documents that they have uncovered, and 3,000 pages. Blix waived this, again, non-evidence, in front of the Security Council. Because the next day, Mohammed al-Baradei, the IAEA, had chided Blix on why did he bring this issue up, because the IA fully knows that that line of research had nothing to do with the nuclear weapon program, that this papers that they found were simply financial statements, old research paper that belonged to this man, to this gentleman. This is very indignifying. This does not allow or encourage other scientists to come out and speak when they see this James Bondian tactics applied to their friends. I wouldn't blame them. We have our dignity. We have our own self-respect, and to be treated like this over the world. And this guy, Faleh Hamza, challenged anybody from the IAEA and Blix and Bradley to even prove one sentence of all the papers they confiscated from him that it had anything to do with nuclear weapon program.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, the actions of the UN inspectors notwithstanding, do you still feel as though the scientists there are free to speak with them, and would they be in a position to give honest and candid responses? And I'd like for you to address the threat that Saddam Hussein poses to them and their families.
I will address that, but I'll tell you one thing. And the IA inspector, one of them, who we have mutual respect, asked me to talk a month ago, and I agreed, but I never came back. And so he sent me an email a few days ago, sorry, the war machine is taking over. We will not interview you. Why don't they interview me? I have nothing to fear. Now I'll come back to your point about the threat to these scientists. Colin Powell's evidence on this is, again, a false evidence. Untrue, completely. Because the documents that he referred to, the declarations that we signed, and believe you me, I read the fine print because I was defining my doctorate on my life. The fine print of the, what declarations stated was that we would be under the penalty of death if we do not hand in all the reports, all the information, all the papers that we have in our possession, private possession, to the inspectors and to the government. That's what the declaration said, not what Colin Powell claimed. It was just exactly the opposite.
Can
you see how Colin Powell has deformed this truth, turned it upside down?
Well, let me play a clip of Powell's speech last week where he talks about the infamous aluminum tubes that the U.S. alleges could be used for enriching uranium to make a nuclear bomb. Scientists around the rest of the world have since discredited what the U.S. has said on this issue, but here's what Powell had to say.
By now, just about everyone has heard of these tubes, and we all know that there are differences of opinion. There is controversy about what these tubes are for. Most U.S. experts think they are intended to serve as rotors and centrifuges used to enrich uranium. Other experts and the Iraqis themselves argue that they are really to produce the rocket bodies for a conventional weapon, a multiple rocket launcher. Let me tell you what is not controversial about these tubes. First, all the experts who have analyzed the tubes in our possession agree that they can be adapted for centrifuge use. Second, Iraq had no business buying them for any purpose. They are banned for Iraq.
Your response, Professor Haduri?
Now the American scientists are telling us how to develop our centrifuge. They're advising us on how to remanufacture these tubes so we can use them for centrifuge. This is ridiculous. These tubes, had they been actually used for such an imaginary project, the size and the structures would require kilometers of length of very precisely controlled rotating spinners made of these tubes. This is just an impossibility to hide in a country as Iraq. Kilometers long of such a process plant is detectable quite easily, I believe, from satellite, and the inspectors running all over Iraq with their cars and their feet and their cameras. Or the electrical power, the stable electrical power that Iraq is badly lacking these days to run these very highly controlled. This is all a figment of the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
These tubes were, well, the only claim that Powell seems to be worried about is that they are very expensive material, aluminum S7000, to be used for mortars. Now he's telling us that we should make cheap mortars because the U.S. doesn't make them that way.
Well, now, you're not denying that these tubes don't have a dual use.
I am denying it completely, yes. They are completely outside the range of being used. The American scientists themselves are saying you have to modify them such and such and such and such in order perhaps to be able to be used.
Mm-hmm. Professor, we hear President Bush and his cabinet say over and over and over again that Saddam Hussein gassed his own people. You were in Iraq during that incident before the Gulf War. Can you shed some light on that situation for us?
I would say one thing. The United States has dropped 30 tons of depleted uranium in the south of Iraq. And they have now shipped there 300 tons of the same material to be again used in Iraq. And for your information, that incident that you mentioned, there is now, I've been reports in the CIA and others, this raising question marks about who actually used that incident, the gas in that incident. Is it Iraqis or is it Iranian? The fingerprints of that stuff apparently is also Iranian, could be Iranian. I'm not defending or not denying. I'm just saying there are reports now that are now disclaiming this event.
But
this is a tragic, horrible human tragedy that happened.
Do you have inside knowledge about that?
No, I'm sorry. I wasn't there, but mostly my heart bleeds for what America is going to do to the America, to the Iraqi people. They're going to, after strangling them for 13 years with this economic sanctions, they're going to go and rape Iraq and rape the Iraqi people. Hundreds of thousands of people are going to be killed. For what? They're going to put democracy in Iraq at the tips of guided missiles? This is a criminal war that's going to happen. If ever there will be an international war tribunal, this will be a classic case of a first-rate crime against a country.
Professor Haduri, I have a difficult question, but I have to ask. People are going to say, well, you don't live in Iraq anymore. You're living in Toronto, Canada, and maybe that's an easy position for you to take, but there are Iraqis living in Baghdad and throughout the country that want to see Saddam Hussein removed from power. What would your response be to that?
I'm sure there are people in the United States who want to see Bush out of power, too. That's my response.
Imad Kaduri is a former Iraqi nuclear scientist. He worked for the Iraqi Atomic Energy Commission for 30 years, from 1968 to 1998. Well, as Bush attempts to make his case for war, more and more he is invoking the language of religion, a position that could backfire if war is actually declared against Iraq. Recently, the Pope rebuffed attempts by the Bush administration to persuade him that impending military action against Baghdad qualified as a just war under Christian doctrine. Russell Mokyber of the Corporate Crime Reporter and host of Fighting Corporate Power on Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington questioned White House spokesman Ari Fleischer about this issue at a recent press conference.
A group of bishops and pastors from the National Council of Churches, United Methodist Church, Episcopal Church, sent a letter to the president last week. They say they want a meeting face-to-face with him because they're, quote, uneasy about the moral justification for war on Iraq. Will the president meet with these church leaders?
So, as always, we'll fill you in on the president's schedule. But I want to emphasize again, the president is a deeply religious man, and there are many people from a variety of religions who are going to have different thoughts about how to keep the peace and whether or not to go to war with Saddam Hussein. The president will respect their thoughts, and he will act as he sees fit as commander-in-chief to protect the country.
Second question on that. You just said the president is a deeply religious man. Jesus Christ was an absolute pacifist. How does the president square his militarism with Jesus' pacifism?
Well, I think there may be a debate in the press corps about your question.
How about Russell, I... the temple with a whip, where he got the hell out of those money changers. Does that sound like he's an absolute pacifist, Barry?
Let him ask the question, seriously.
Thank you.
Peace Watch spoke with Russell Mokyber about his experience at the press conference and Bush's use of religion as a marketing tool for war against Iraq.
Ari Fleischer said he's a very religious man. And the president has said that Jesus Christ is his favorite philosopher. Well, given all that, I wanted to know why it was that the president is being criticized by the bishop of his own church about this militarism, and whether or not he would meet with the churches who have called for an anti-war delegation. I wanted to know how he squared his policy of militarism with Jesus Christ's pacifism. And when I asked that question, I was pretty surprised at this because this has never happened.
Mm-hmm.
I was being ridiculed by a number of reporters in the press briefing room who started shouting at me that Christ was not, as I put it, an absolute pacifist. Mm-hmm. And one of the reporters, Lester Consolving, said, well, what about when he kicked the money changers out of the temple and he whipped them or something?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did a little research, and what the press conference ended at that with Ari saying, Russell, your own colleagues have a problem with your question.
Mm-hmm.
And he walked out without answering the question. I'm going to ask it again because I think it's unfair that he got out of answering the question. He could deny that Christ was a pacifist. He can mm-hmm. say Christ was not a pacifist. Or he could say that Christianity has evolved and now the Christian church believes in just wars. But he should be required to answer. I think a number of reporters were saying, yes, he should have answered that question.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to ask it again.
And I guess that is an ongoing debate as to whether or not Christ was an absolute pacifist or not.
Well, I discussed this with Coleman McCarthy, who is a pacifist and who teaches peace studies.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, historically, the right wing uses this example of the temple where Christ kicked over some tables and made a whip. But there's no evidence that he whipped anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only example that they come up with. Well, if that's the level of his aggression, then he's a pretty passive person. And his entire philosophy was pacifism.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple centuries later, the church hijacked the philosophy and, you know, ran roughshod over the earth.
I think that there probably is debate around what pacifism actually mean? What is the definition of pacifism? Does it mean that you're a person that's opposed to war? Or does it mean that you're completely opposed to any kind of aggressive behavior whatsoever?
Well, there's a debate, but as Coleman says, pacifism does not mean passivity.
Yes.
And it means, in its best sense, in the Gandhian sense, it means active resistance, active nonviolence resistance to injustice and power.
Which is a very, which is something very different from passivity.
Yes.
And someone with a personality that is passive and just non-assertive, non-aggressive.
Well, that was more Christ-like. The meek shall inherit the earth. But for the Bushites to say, to claim Jesus Christ, for President Bush to claim Jesus Christ as his favorite philosopher, and then build the greatest military machine in history,
and refuse to meet with any
anti-war protesters, refuse to meet with his own bishop from his own church to hear the moral objections to this war, is unconscionable. And I think one of the problems is that President Bush is in a cocoon, and he's not hearing other points of view. So I would hope that he would sit down with these bishops, the bishop of his own church, the leaders of these other churches, and at least hear them out.
Does he intend to? We don't know. We have to wait for the answer to that question when you pose it again to Ari Fleischer. I thought it was also interesting that this was something that the other reporters in the room decided to respond to. Have they ever done a follow-up question on your behalf once you've entered a line of questioning that may be uncomfortable for Ari Fleischer to respond to?
Often reporters do follow up, but you know, reporters want to ask their own questions. And you're given so little time that you go in with the question you want to ask and you try and get it in. That's true of me and probably all the other reporters. But there was a split in the room. I find it interesting that some reporters challenged me on whether Christ was a pacifist, but others wanted an answer. Let Ari answer the question. And he just turned on his heel and walked out of the room.
Russell Mokyber of the Corporate Crime Reporter and co-host of Fighting Corporate Power on Pacifica Station WPFW. He did eventually re-ask that question, but got a less satisfactory answer than the first time.
I was taught and brought up there, the laws to abide, and that the land that I live in has God on its side. Oh, the history books tell it, they tell it so well. The cavalry's charged, the Indians fell. The cavalry's charged, the Indians died. Oh, the country was young with God on its side.
Bob Dylan with God on our side. What is the price of war, and what precisely does it cost to project the will of the United States abroad? Christopher Simpson, professor of communications at American University, author and analyst, looks at the history of declining empires and draws some stark parallels to the current state of affairs with the United States and Iraq.
The empire that the United States established after World War II is more and more fragile. It's more difficult to manage. It's much more expensive to manage. And while it's still profitable to the U.S. government, it's much less profitable as a percentage of what it costs to keep it going. And the U.S. government doesn't really have a solution to this. We've been in this situation with other world empires, with the British Empire, with the French Empire, with the Russian Empire, and so on, Austro-Hungarian, Ottomans, whatever. So there's a big track record of how empires deal with the reality that they're coming apart. It's possible to compare, say, the British experience with what's going on in the United States now. And what you see happening is, first of all, the governments in power refuse to face reality. They refuse to come to grips with it, and they'll put off facing their actual problems as long as they possibly can. Second of all, empires in decline are particularly dangerous, and in many cases have turned to genocide and different forms of mass murder to keep themselves in power. Third of all, even those tactics, as frightening as they are, those tactics fail to hold the empire together because it's internally so unstable. The cost of maintaining the empire is a constant battle as to who's going to pick up that money, who's going to pick up the bill. In this country, one can see a concerted effort to push those costs off onto the shoulders of the middle class, working class, and poor people. But the basic pattern of what's taking place, that's not a mystery. People can see it with their own eyes. When an empire starts, the way it runs is by expanding and taking things from other people, it gets rich. And that type of theft is profitable, quote-unquote, right? So that the expansion of the empire in its early phases actually has the appearance of making the central country stronger because it's stealing wealth from around the world. Once upon a time, Portugal was a world power, world-class power. Why? Because Portugal's so big, has such a big population? No. But because, for a variety of reasons, it had been able to lay claim and steal quite a bit of resources from the New World, and also from Africa. What happens is that as time goes by, the cost of stealing gets higher. It's more expensive to steal, and you have to work harder to get less. And as that happens, a couple things take place. One is that the various sort of puppet or cooperative governments that support this empire around the world, they want a bigger piece of the pie, not surprisingly. Ordinary people, to the extent that they can, they want better standard of living. Well, that's expensive from the standpoint of the world managers. And the armed forces and spy agencies, all this sort of stuff necessary to hold the thing together, they get more and more expensive. In past empires, you know, there's a lot of questions. Well, how come empires sometimes fall apart? Why did the Roman Empire fall apart? All that. And there's a couple theories. And one of the theories is that they have some sort of, like maybe a disease crisis that they can't fix. And so people get sick and the empire falls apart. Another is an economic crisis of some sort. Maybe they run out of some mineral or something. And there's other theories as well. But what one can see if you look at this is that young empires are able to withstand a lot of shocks, you know, a lot of problems, diseases, loss of minerals, this thing, that thing. Why? Because they've been able to steal enough to create a big reserve so that when there's a very stressful period, they're able to pay for it. Well, what one sees in the United States, particularly in the last 20 years, is that reserve is thinner and thinner and thinner. The petroleum reserve, right? Privatized, sold off. Mineral reserves, privatized, sold off. Even what you might call the military forces. I'm not talking about reserves in the sense of civilian reserves. I'm talking about the amount of terror that a state can bring to bear on a particular situation. That is more and more privatized. That is more and more fragile, really, even when it looks its strongest. And I think that that's where the United States is now. And I think that the real problem, the real challenge for progressive people in the United States, or at least one of them, not the only one, obviously, is to figure out how to bring this empire to a peaceful dissolution without it setting out to commit mass crimes. And if you think about it, this was exactly what was on the agenda in the old Soviet Union about 10, 15 years ago, is how for the Soviet Union to change out of the type of extraordinarily bureaucratized form of government that it had without setting off an atomic war in the process, or without setting off colonial wars in the process. Here in the United States, we're so trapped in the ideology of we're number one, we got to be number one, and if it seems like we're not number one, then we'll bomb them into oblivion, that the problem of preventing colonial wars, or what would today be called colonial wars, wars of different forms of mass killing, that's more difficult than ever.
Author analyst Christopher Simpson teaches at American University. Thanks to independent producer Eddie Becker for that segment. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.